From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison.
All members vote who desire to vote.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We've got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
Well, that montage signals the start of a new feature on Insight. It's called Capital Chat. Each week, we'll talk with reporters at our Capital Bureau about what's happening in California state government and what that activity or lack of activity means for you. Usually, this feature will air on Fridays, but we're so excited about Capital Chat, we couldn't wait another day, and we're debuting it on a Thursday. That's our story. Anyway, and we'll stick with it. Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, is in our studio down at the Bureau. Marianne, thanks for joining us today.
No, oh, it's great to be here with you.
Well, what's occupying lawmakers and lobbyists right now at the Capitol?
I'd say there are three things. Bills, bills, and more bills. It's a very hectic time of year down here. Lawmakers are churning through really hundreds of bills. You know, typically they'll have session twice a week, sometimes for a pretty short time. But right now we have session pretty much every day, sometimes all day. They could go 8 or 9 hours. And next week, since it's the final week of session, we may see some of those sessions go late into the night. Just for an example, one day this week, the Senate alone worked through 110 bills. And most of these bills have to go through both houses within this time period because one house has typically made some sort of amendments to it, and then it has to go back to the other one for what we call concurrence or final approval or rejection.
I see. Concurrence, I guess, is where things need to be reconciled, where the two houses pass different aspects of the same issue.
Absolutely. It's also a really fun time of year, Jeffrey, being a reporter, because you're running back and forth between the two houses and, oh, is this bill up? No, that bill's up. Oh, it's over here. And it gets to be, quite a lot of fun following the legislation. It's also, I would say, probably the busiest time in the hallways because we have our own version of Gucci Gulch, where all the lobbyists hang out. And you can really tell just from how many lobbyists there are outside the two chambers, that it's definitely end of session.
Yeah. You mentioned 110 bills. It's hard to imagine how anyone could cope with that kind of flow of information. What do lawmakers say about that? How do they do it?
Actually, one lawmaker did tell me that was probably the toughest thing, was just keeping up with the issues. Although many of these issues, it's worth pointing out, they have been talking about them since the beginning of the year. There are also the new ones that they introduce at the last minute through a process known as gut and amend. Those may be a little tougher for some lawmakers to grasp. It's also a pretty hectic time for them. I spoke with a couple of them about what it's like. Republican Senator Tony Strickland compared it to another very busy time in his life.
It's sort of like college when you haven't done a term paper or you haven't done studying for your finals and you have to cram at the end, the very end. It's almost the same thing.
But I guess it's for the legislative leaders that it's the biggest challenge.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Democratic Senate leader Daryl Steinberg has a huge job this time of year, as does Speaker John Perez in the Assembly. Steinberg is corralling votes, working out differences. In fact, he told me he's part-time therapist, a full-time leader.
It is like 50 to 100 meteors coming at you at one time, every day, constantly. What occurs on the floor and all the deals you're trying to bring together that have been worked on over the course of an entire year, sometimes for 2 years, it is the most intense part of the experience for me.
Well, let's talk about some of the bills and what's happened to them. One bill that I've certainly been hearing a lot about, getting emails about from people at the Capitol, is a bill called AB 52 that would change the way health insurance rates are regulated in California. Tell us a bit more about that and what happened.
Sure, yeah. This was a very contentious, very high-profile bill. It would have allowed the state insurance commissioner to regulate health insurance rate hikes. So he already has that authority with other types of insurance, like auto coverage. But he doesn't have it with health care, and he really wanted it so that he could reject hikes that he thought were excessive. But yesterday, Democratic Assemblyman Mike Fuhr told us that he didn't have enough votes from Democrats in the Senate to push the measure through. Well, we knew it was having a tough time, and there was talk of perhaps the bill being amended on the Senate floor. But at this point, Fuhr is telling us that he is going to be doing a lot of arm twisting between the end of session and next year.
A rate regulation bill
that assures that our health insurance rates are affordable has to be meaningfully protective of small businesses, working families, and consumers. Anything short of that is just the pretense of reform.
And what about the insurance companies? What do they have to say?
Yeah, well, the bill actually had a lot of critics, including, of course, insurance companies, doctors, hospitals, and even the governor's Department of Finance, which is important because that could signal a veto. They all argued it would not do anything to address the problem of rising health care costs and created more bureaucracy. We spoke with Patrick Johnston with the California Association of Health Plans, and he says he's not surprised the bill stalled.
They all saw this was a complicated, overly bureaucratic restraint on the ability to get approval and to have competitive health insurance available to people.
Now, if I may give a tip of the hat to our colleague Ben Adler, the first I heard about the imminent shelving of AB 52 was from Ben on his Twitter feed.
And I'm glad you did, because I was going to if you didn't. He did a great job. He was over there getting some interviews on other topics and saw the assemblyman and spoke with him about it, and I believe was the first to know about it. So we were glad that he tweeted that quickly, because it caught on pretty fast.
It did indeed. Now, another bill concerns something that's in baby bottles. What is this?
Yes, this is something called BPA. It's bisphenol A, but you typically see it even on some products now. You'll see the sign BPA free. This bill would ban that chemical in just a few products, baby bottles and sippy cups for kids 3 years old and under. And it isn't the first time lawmakers have tried a BPA ban. We've covered this many times in the past. This one is pretty narrow, but it still just barely passed the Senate this week and does have to go back to the Assembly for final approval. Supporters say there's a lot of evidence that BPA disrupts hormones, especially in young children and babies. We spoke with Democratic Senator Fran Pavley. She's been a big advocate of the ban. And she said on the floor this week that even though BPA-free products are available, they're not always easy to find in some lower-income communities.
This bill protects the health and safety of children in everyone's neighborhood, will not allow the supposedly dumping of BPA products in some neighborhoods over others. It levels the playing field. It's a smart, practical decision.
So the BPA ban has passed the Senate and is going back to the Assembly for the concurrence that we talked about earlier. Nevertheless, what are opponents saying?
Yeah, Republicans are opposed to it. GOP Senate Leader Bob Dutton sent out a press release. He called it a feel-good junk science bill that takes away consumer choice. They've labeled it a job killer. On the floor during the debate, Republican Senator Sam Blakesley pointed out that the state has already set up a green chemistry initiative, and they are working on this regulatory body that's designed to make decisions about chemicals in California. And he says a bill like this goes back on that process.
And we, in effect, would be continuing with our chemical-by-chemical, product-by-product ban, which I think as a body we agreed to cease and desist such effort and instead have a more robust regulatory process. So I'd urge respectfully a no vote.
You're listening to Capital Chat. It's a new feature on Insight. We're talking about what's going on at the California state government. Joining us from our bureau is Marion Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Well, another bill that's caught a lot of attention for a variety of reasons is the DREAM Act, which affects immigrants, specifically when it comes to education. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is actually something we've covered for years. It made it through the legislature in the past and been vetoed previously. And this time, it's actually a two-part package known as the California DREAM Act. The measure that passed the Senate yesterday allows some undocumented college students to compete for state financial aid. Now, that could include assistance offered by individual colleges and universities, and in some cases, Cal grants, although that's only after all legal resident students have gotten the Cal grants they qualified for. Democratic Senator Ron Calderon is a big fan of the bill. He presented it on the Senate floor.
Those who work hard and become good students should not be punished for decisions made by their parents.
But this is such a controversial issue, especially among people who are particularly concerned about illegal immigration.
It is. It's a very controversial issue. Yesterday's debate in the Senate was actually fairly short, which surprised me because the debate in the Assembly had been quite lengthy. One Assemblyman, Tim Donnelly, a Republican, is quite opposed. And he said, you know, it provides an incentive for undocumented students to come to California. And he points out that those students can't get work permits after they graduate.
I think it's a really misguided use of taxpayer resources. I think at a time when we're slashing funding to the CSU and UC by $1 billion, we've raised tuition 12% on the students, and now we're saying that somehow we discovered some cache of money to hand over to people who've come into the country illegally.
So part two of the DREAM Act has passed the Senate, back to the Assembly, also for concurrence. Let's touch on a couple of other things. There was a bill, a very high-profile bill, an important bill for the Assembly Speaker, John Perez, that he's been pushing for, that would eliminate this tiny city of Vernon in Southern California. But his signature legislation failed.
Yes, it did. It was a two-part package, but the first part couldn't make it past the Senate floor. As you said, it would have disincorporated that city of Vernon. It's a tiny, corruption-plagued city, but it employs tens of thousands of people. Perez said it was too corrupt to be reformed, and he really muscled the bill through the Assembly, but in the Senate, he only got 13 yes votes, which means a number of Democrats either voted against it or abstained. Other Democratic senators have been pushing bills that reform the city of Vernon. They're saying we can fix it instead of just getting rid of it. Afterwards, the speaker was clearly very angry. He issued a press release that mentioned those who came out against his bill by name, including Democratic Senator Kevin DeLeon. That's pretty unusual. And he had a very biting quote. He said they would, quote, own the responsibility for any misdeeds that may occur in the future. Now, something that there's been a lot of talk about at the Capitol is, you know, will there be any retribution? Should we be paying really close attention to the De Leon bills that are in the Assembly at this point? And, you know, will the Speaker, you know, do something to keep those bills back? At this point, it's just a wait and see.
A big day for a Sacramento Judge Goodwin Liu. What's happening to him?
He is going to be sworn in by Governor Brown today to the state Supreme Court. So, yes, it will be a big day. In fact, that's supposed to happen, I believe, right at noon in the rotunda. I've heard from the governor's press office that there will be at least 100 or so dignitaries there. So a pretty big deal.
And he had been nominated for federal court before, but that was held up because some Republicans in Congress thought that he was too radical, I guess.
That's true. But here in California, the Commission on Judicial Appointments didn't have any concerns, and he was unanimously confirmed.
And what about Governor Brown? We haven't mentioned him too much on today's Capitol Chat, but he made a fairly noteworthy comment earlier this week.
He did. He was at a clean energy summit in Las Vegas, and I think he actually made more headlines for talking about taxes than he did about energy. We'll let him speak for himself.
It's a product of this notion that the taxes are like, you know, some kind of sexually transmitted disease.
So there you go. He's well known for pithy statements.
Yes. And finally, Marianne, what's going to happen between now and I guess in a week's time when the session ends? Just more bills, bills, bills.
Yeah, very much so. We expect to see the long days of session continue, the lobbying, the deal making, the panic by some lawmakers. Although I will point out that this is the first year of a 2-year session, which means that bills that don't make it through right now still have a chance to make it next year. They become what we call over here a 2-year bill. So you don't see quite the panic that you might at the end of next year, especially when you're working with termed out lawmakers who really want to get something through before they're done.
Well, this is the start of what we hope will be more than a 2-year segment, Capital Chat. Marianne Russ, our guest today, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. After this week, Capital Chat will air each Friday on Insight. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, tips from Pittsburgh on how to do big things like building sports facilities without raising taxes. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is online. Joining us with more information about what's online is Insight senior producer Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning.
What do we have?
Well, on Tuesday, we talked about methyl iodide's use on strawberries, and we asked our listeners and fans on Facebook if they were concerned at all about pesticide use on their fruits and vegetables. Joe in Fair Oaks wrote, "The chemical being applied to strawberries goes into the ground, not on the berries or leaves, but pesticide residue on fruits is a concern. We wash everything, but still there's a concern. Some supermarkets used to advertise that they tested for residue, but we don't see that being listed anymore." And another listener, Judy, who's also concerned about chemicals and her diet and how they impact the world, has taken a number of steps on her own, including raising chickens for eggs, buying organic as much as possible, planting fruit trees and drying the excess to use throughout the year, and having a veggie garden. I kind of want to move in with Judy. We also have a correction on one of our stories. On Monday, we talked about new legislation that requires the pertussis vaccination for all school-age children. Many people know it as whooping cough, but listener Beverly, who's also an RN, emailed us this. The W in whooping cough is silence, as in the word who, so it should be pronounced whooping cough. It is a tribute to the years of successful immunization that so many people are unfamiliar with the sound of the horrible cough that gave the disease its nickname.
And I was one of those people unfamiliar with the fact of the matter.
So was I. And that's why we checked a number of sources, including two different healthcare reporters. And Beverly is correct. According to one reporter I talked with, they always say pertussis now in an effort to avoid any confusion, since more people are familiar with whooping cough, not whooping cough. And I think in this particular case, it's probably better to be a print reporter. So, Jeffrey, I think you have an update for us on Capital Public Radio's Amazon affiliate status.
Yeah, we talked about this subject a few weeks ago about the tussle between Amazon, the state of California, and Amazon's associates. It's over sales taxes. And I did note, in the interest of disclosure, that Capital Public Radio was an Amazon affiliate or associate, as Amazon calls it. There was some question over our status at that time. Well, we just got an email, Capital Public Radio did, from Amazon yesterday. It's titled, "Dear former Amazon associates," I guess that answers that part of it. "We just got a payment for $138.45. That's the final payment on our recently closed account." So Capital Public Radio and Amazon are no more.
Well, if you have any comments or questions on anything you've heard on Insight, please don't hesitate to email us, insight@capradio.org, or go to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. And with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 fast approaching, we'd really like to hear your memories and thoughts about that day and how, if it does, still affect you.
Well, thank you, Jen.
You're very welcome.
When it comes to getting things done in Sacramento, you hear plenty of gloom and doom. But the former mayor of Pittsburgh came to town yesterday and said big projects can be done. The important thing is to think big and lead from the front. And he should know, when Tom Murphy was mayor of Pittsburgh, he led the construction of two sports venues and a convention center without raising taxes. He spoke yesterday morning at Sacramento City Hall, and the talk was titled "Adapting Cities for the Future, What It Takes to Be a Successful 21st Century City." Given that, I asked Tom Murphy what it takes to be a 21st century city.
We are at a moment of remarkable change in our society, in part because of not the recession, though that is part of it, but the technology changes, the globalization of trade, particularly energy demands, the demographics that we're adding 100 million more people to the United States over the next 20 years. Sacramento is going to continue to grow by hundreds of thousands of people. And what are the changes that cause that cities need to plan and invest for, rather than sort of assuming that the city is going to be like it was? And I think that pace of change is pretty remarkable.
What kind of city was Pittsburgh when you became mayor, which was
1994? Pittsburgh is a real example, as are other places, that had to transform itself. We were forced to. We were a steel town. I grew up there, and everybody, 60% of the people in Pittsburgh worked in heavy manufacturing, and we were very polluted, probably one of the most environmentally degraded places in the country, and now we are very different, but it was a painful transformation.
The industry that had defined Pittsburgh for so long was declining. how does Pittsburgh earn its living now?
Much more diverse economy, and a large part of it is driven by technology, universities and hospitals. And that's part of what I talked about yesterday morning at your event, is that in the last 20 years, between 1990 and 2010, Sacramento lost 20% of its manufacturing base. But it gained almost 100% increase in people working in education and healthcare and technology. So there's three times more people working in technology jobs in the Sacramento area than there are in manufacturing jobs. What does that do to your economy? How does it change the land use, the educational requirements, lots of different things?
What were you specifically able to do as mayor of Pittsburgh to turn the city around and make it a more prosperous and dynamic place to be?
Well, it wasn't just me. I mean, we built a strong partnership between the public and the private civic leadership sector, business leaders and nonprofits in it. The one we did is that we very much focused on land use. We had lots of old vacant steel mills, and as mayor, I directed our development authority to acquire those, and we redeveloped them, and believing that we could create value with property that had been vacant and dilapidated and really symbols of our decline. We invested heavily into education, increased dramatically our high school graduation rates, and we really began to see the universities and the hospitals, and particularly the research they were doing, as the new raw materials, not coal in the ground, but and UC Davis, for example, gets almost $700 million a year in research dollars annually. And the ability to convert that to commerce, to capture new companies or companies that have reason to be here in the Sacramento area doing that, working with the universities, became really valuable. So I would say the dominant industrial sector in Pittsburgh now is technology-related jobs. So that change from working in a steel mill to working with a technology company is very painful, but one that I believe is going to be necessary for a lot of cities.
Did that change require a lot of public money?
It required some public money. It required really good partnerships. We made public investment, and we were a city like every city that had not, we didn't have a lot of money. We were losing population. We were losing development. And
so, where did you get the money from?
Well, we made hard choices. Number one is that when a city says we don't have any money, and this was part of the conversation this morning, I said, well, what's the budget of Sacramento? It's $800 million a year. So when you say you don't have any money, you're not really telling me the truth. You're spending $800 million a year. It's a question of where you spend it. And you can spend it all today just keeping everything running, or you can say we're going to try to do that more efficiently and shift some of the money and use it to invest with private developers in developing steel mills or railroad yards or lots of things like that, thousands of acres of that we had.
My guest is Tom Murphy. He's a former mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, and he's currently a senior resident fellow at the Urban Land Institute. Did the state of Pennsylvania also kick in money?
They were great partners in both Republican and Democratic governors. Tom Ridge was a governor of Pennsylvania. He's Republican. I was a Democrat for 8 years. And they were good partners in providing some financing and changing some. In some cases, it wasn't money as much as changing the regulatory climate that made it easier to do what we wanted to do. For example, in cities, many cities have problems with abandoned property and delinquent property. These are pieces of property that people have quit paying taxes on, and they blight a neighborhood. And there was a very cumbersome years and years process for us to be able to get that property and to put it back into commerce. And, we were able to change the laws at the state to make that a more efficient process.
Now, what about the private sector? We've talked about public investment. Pittsburgh has long had a pretty big private sector,
right?
Foundations as well as corporations.
Right.
Sacramento really doesn't have that to the same extent. How important was that private sector element in Pittsburgh?
The big corporations were have an organization part of the chamber's part of it called the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Really, very important partners. Pittsburgh is blessed with a lot of big foundations, and they were hugely helpful, particularly for arts and culture, and also taking some big risk. For example, we built our convention center. At the time, it was the largest certified green building in America, and we made a choice to do that, but the Hines Endowment agreed to underwrite the cost of the design competition that got us to having that green building. And so there were those kind of partnerships. And then when we as a city bought a lot of acres of steel mills, and then we partnered with private developers to build on those steel mills to the quality we wanted, and we helped finance it because there were real risk in doing development on property that had been used for industrial purposes for 100 years.
Well, you were mayor. Pittsburgh got two new sports facilities,
right,
for the city's football and baseball teams. As I'm sure you know, Sacramento has been struggling for years to figure out a way to build a new arena,
right,
for the Sacramento Kings or for some future team if they happen to leave. What advice would you give the city, given this long history of not being able to come up with the money?
That it's you can come up with the money. It won't be pretty. There'll be a lot of people mad about it, but you can figure it out. We financed our, we made a decision to build a baseball, football, and a new convention center all at the same time. It was about $1.2 billion
investment. And did that help or hinder the fact that you're doing this all as one big package?
Well, it brought, instead of trying to pick and choose which one you were going to do first, you would have ended up balkanized and everybody. As a new mayor, several months into my first term, I stood up at a big meeting and said, rather than, trying to decide whether we're going to build a baseball or football or convention center, because each one had constituencies.
Sure.
Let's just figure out how to do them all at one time. And actually, we really actually went to the hockey team also and said, do you want a new arena? We had old arena. And I said, people are not going to yell any more or less whether we do three or four of these things, right? So he actually said, let's just do some improvements. And we have since now built a new arena, but since I left as mayor. But we had no money, and we're a flat, broke city, and you just begin to put the pieces together. There are lots of revenue streams that people need to think about. We didn't raise taxes, but first the teams put a little bit of money in. And then there are revenue streams that flow into one of these facilities, whether it's baseball, football, or basketball, meaning there's naming rights and concessions, the food and signage and parking and a host of other revenue streams. And so there's a negotiation. The team needs money, obviously, to be competitive, to pay their players, but some of those revenue streams can get diverted to helping to finance the facility.
And that added up?
And we figured it out. We nickel and dimed it here, a nickel here, a dime here, and at the end of the day, we were able to put it together without having to raise existing taxes. I mean, to build it off of of revenue streams that we could identify. And it added up. And the result, people were mad about it, and there was a lot of controversy.
Sounds familiar.
But then the Steelers win the Super Bowl.
That helps, doesn't it?
And I would say, actually a couple of weeks ago, a TV reporter called me up and said, can we do an interview with you? And the first question, the Pirates actually were in first place, which is the first time in
they had a good
17 years. We have a decent team, a relatively decent team this year. And the first question out of his mouth is, do you feel vindicated? Because I was not the most popular guy in the world when we did this, okay?
Well, did you?
I did. It's created hundreds of millions of dollars of new investment around it. We didn't leave, as sort of you see with a lot of older stadiums, 20 acres of surface parking lots. And instead, we built parking garages and worked with the teams to do a lot of development. So there's hundreds of millions of office buildings and commercial and retail stuff.
Finally, Tom Murphy, one question about the powers that you had as mayor. I don't know if the same term is used outside of California, but in California they talk about quote-unquote strong mayors and weak mayors.
Same term.
Same term, yeah. So what kind of mayor does Pittsburgh have? A strong
mayor. Very strong mayor.
Did that help?
I think it helps. It helps. I mean, I have 9 members on a council, and for me to proceed with this, I needed to get at least 5 votes. So it was, in that sense, it was a strong mayor. We did not have a city manager, so I had the hiring and firing responsibilities for all the directors of departments, and also had the initiative, the ability to initiate these kinds of things. But it really goes to the essence of leadership. I think the leadership can come from a lot of different places. It can come from civic leaders. It can come from the political leadership. I think it's a willingness of people to take some risk for the future and to recognize that this might not be possible or popular now, but in the long term, it's going to help to create a 21st century city in Sacramento. And that leadership can come from lots of different places, and I think that is the key. It is in many ways easier if you have a mayor, strong or weak, who begins to put the pieces together to make this happen. And let me say, every city has that capacity. It's a choice that cities make.
Mm. Tom Murphy, former mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, he's now a senior resident fellow at the Urban Land Institute. Was invited to Sacramento to give a talk on adapting cities for the future, what it takes to be a successful 21st century city. Tom Murphy, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how the changing Arctic is raising the stakes for nearby countries, including the U.S. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with details is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio senior editor. He's in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. If you get nervous driving on some of those 2-lane back roads in California, a group called TRIP, or the Road Improvement Project, says you got good reason to be. The nonprofit research group says California has the 5th highest rural traffic fatality rate in the country. And rural roads are indeed worst in the state. 38%, almost 40% of all the traffic fatalities in California occur on rural non-interstate roads.
Well, that's sobering information. And what about the roads and the rivers and so on the East Coast?
Well, that's a problem, got to tell you. They're still trying to dig out and dry out after Hurricane Irene. So understand there's some wary weather eyes looking out over the deep Atlantic right now where Hurricane Katia is gathering. Katia's winds running about 75 miles an hour right now. Could be a good chance. This, though, could veer off into the North Atlantic before landfall and actually blow itself out over the ocean. Whew, what a relief that would be.
Yes.
Those stories on All Things Considered this afternoon beginning at 3:30 on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
One of the biggest issues this century might well be the Arctic. A lot of the ice at the top of the Earth has melted due to climate change, and that's expected to continue. And that means things that before weren't possible, like shipping lanes and drilling, now are or could be soon. And that's raised the stakes big time for countries that assert a claim to part of the Arctic, including the US. Others include Russia and Canada. The future of the Arctic and the legal and political implications for this country and others is the subject of a talk today at UC Davis by an expert on international law. He's David Caron, law professor at UC Berkeley, where he's also co-chair of the Miller Institute for Global Challenges. He's also current president of the American Society for International Law. David Caron, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff. I'm here in UC Davis, and it's a beautiful day.
It is indeed. Well, who owns the Arctic, or at least controls it?
Well, the Arctic is a very big area. It's several times larger than the Mediterranean. There are rules about how nations may make claims into the ocean area. The big message for your readers, for your listeners, is that in the past, all the issues in the Arctic were dormant because of the ice. It may be that they could have claimed, but they weren't really in a rush to do so. As it melts, what was asleep, what was dormant, is now very active. And so states are, I think it's an exaggeration to say that they're somehow moving toward conflict, but they are being energetic, in fact, working together to figure out who has a proper claim to what.
I've heard that traditionally nations were fairly cooperative among themselves when it came to dealing with the Arctic. But didn't Russia send some robot down to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean and plant a Russian flag there just to say, hey, this is ours?
Exactly. And I think you should view it in that my little laugh. It, in many ways, it has no legal significance. It is a indication of their view of the Arctic. One thing that I think every country tends to look at their slice of the Arctic, and Americans here talk about opening drilling north of Alaska, but what needs to be appreciated is that Russia really dominates the Arctic. If you took a look in latitude, lines of longitude, Russia has six time zones facing on the Arctic, and they internally they view it as pretty much their area. That's not to say the other side, but they're very excited about the Arctic. They view it as something that opens up Siberia in a way that has never happened before. They have very many major rivers. So this is, for them, a very big deal, and we should appreciate that if you step back and look at the Arctic as a whole, they are the main presence in the Arctic.
My guest is David Caron, law professor at UC Berkeley. He's at UC Davis today, where he'll be talking at 4 this afternoon at the Kalmanovitz Appellate Courtroom at King Hall about the Arctic, images of the Arctic and the future, as they suggest, is the title of his talk. What is under the Arctic, or even in the Arctic, that Russia and other countries are so interested in?
Well, there is a rather famous U.S. Geological Survey map now that lays out estimates of oil and gas in the Arctic, and they are estimates. In a world that needs oil, there's a drive to look for that. There is a few locations. One location is in the basin between Canada and Alaska, and so the Beaufort Sea. And so that is one focus of attention for the United States. It is an area that the border is not resolved, and it will be difficult to resolve that border. The legal positions have emerged, but it'll be a difficult issue.
Why will it be difficult?
But most of the oil, I should just finish, is on the Russian side.
I see.
But why will it be difficult? Because they have two very different positions. On the one hand, the Canadians argue that the land boundary, which was agreed to in a treaty between Canada, the Northwest Province, and Alaska, which is a line of longitude and therefore goes north-south directly, the Canadians argue that that treaty line continues into the ocean and goes directly north. The American argument is that that line ends when it reaches the ocean, and that the usual rough description of the rule is that you draw up perpendicular to the coastline. And the coastline there would actually put the border going more to in a northeasterly direction. So you get quite a wedge of difference, and in the wedge is oil, quite likely. I think, assumed to be highly likely that there is oil in that area.
Well, it sounds like there's potentially plenty of work for ambassadors and for diplomats and for lawyers in all of this. Where do you think it's going to head, though? Do you see the potential for serious conflict among these countries?
No, I don't really. I don't see conflict. What I see is, if we watched what happened in Japan this spring with nuclear power, the accident in Japan sends a message against nuclear power around the world. And we see a change in Germany, for example, just these past couple weeks where they closed down some plants. In the Arctic, another thing to be appreciated is that the ice, even as it retreats, it doesn't retreat uniformly. It actually goes in a kind of counterclockwise way and goes up against Canada. Now, what that means is that Russia opens first, and indeed it's already open. So not only is Russia the main presence in the Arctic, but Russia will go first in virtually every way. Russia will be the one that develops offshore oil first. Russia will be the one that has the shipping that goes through the Bering Strait first. And in that sense, I think one of the things to really watch for is not the border conflict, but the potential for accidents in the Arctic. The Bering Strait, we are, as a nation, both on the Russian side and on the U.S. side, not ready for the level of traffic that may start to go through that rather narrow strait in the summer months. Mm. We need to bear in mind that even as the Arctic, the ice retreats, it still has a rather formidable winter. What we're talking about is opportunities for development in the summertime. And that's to emphasize the opportunities. There's obviously losses in the Arctic as well, losses of certain environmental niches, and that's also of concern.
David Karam, law professor at UC Berkeley. He's a specialist in international law. This afternoon at 4 at King Hall on the UC Davis campus, he'll be giving a lecture and visual tour of the Arctic, identifying the politics and political and legal challenges facing the changing Arctic and the countries in that vicinity. David Karam, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, classical sound advice, including a symphony created from the film music for The Lord of the Rings. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Now our weekly music feature sound advice with new releases and a wide variety of music. This week it's classical. I'm joined by Kent Teeters from Capital Public Radio's classical station. Kent, welcome back. And we're going to start with something very familiar.
Yes. And indeed, there's kind of a Canadian, even a French-Canadian theme going through here. This new CD from the King's Violins, and I'm going to have to rely on your pronunciation. The correct name of the group is?
In French, Les Violons du Roi.
Très bien. This is a wonderful little CD called Bonbons. And, well, I think just about everybody's going to recognize this first bit of music. As you'd expect from an ensemble that specializes in the period, this CD includes Baroque music written by a variety of composers, famous works by Bach, Henry Purcell, and others, including this beautiful, simply beautiful oboe concerto by Alessandro Marcello. Get any phone calls. The first thing we started with was Pachelbel's Canon, and it is a group that specializes in Baroque music. They've received a Juno Award for Classical Album of the Year, which is pretty much the Canadian equivalent of the Grammy. They've also started taking on a broader repertoire, even 20th century works, proving that they're not just a one-trick, one-period kind of ensemble. On this recording, they take on a little Mozart for us.
A That's Eine kleine Nachtmusik by Mozart, a little night music. Sounds like an absolutely charming record, good for anyone wanting to be introduced to classical music.
I think so, and it's just a wonderful ensemble. They play so well, they tune their instruments up to the normal pitch rather than playing down as they usually do during the Baroque period music for Mozart, and I've heard them perform Bartok, and they tune their instruments up, and they sound like just any other chamber ensemble. Very versatile, very talented.
Now, we have, by way of contrast, another piece by Mozart, but much more somber work.
Much more somber, and I couldn't help but have something related to 9/11. And to me, what comes to mind, and at my previous radio station, the piece that we decided we had to play after the 9/11 tragedy was Mozart's Requiem. This is from the Handel and Haydn Society. It's a new recording. The Handel and Haydn Society is a chorus and period instrument orchestra in Boston. They were founded in 1815, and
wow,
they continue to be one of the oldest performing arts organizations in the United States. They started doing an annual performance of Handel's Messiah back in 1854. Harry Christophers has been the artistic director of the group since 2009, and as I say, this is a new recording of Mozart's Requiem. This is the Lacrimosa section, That Day of Tears and Mourning.
Beautiful, one of the most haunting pieces of music ever written, Mozart's Requiem. You're listening to Sound Advice on Insight. My guest is Kent Teeters. What's our next piece of music?
Well, certainly a change of mood and a change of period. Michael Torkey is one of my favorite contemporary composers. He was born in 1961 in Milwaukee. He's sometimes described as a post-minimalist composer. His best-known work is probably Javelin, which was composed for the 1994 Atlanta Summer Olympics. He's also, I had to look this word up, he's a synesthete and can actually see colors as he listens to music. And that was the genesis of his other best-known group of works called color music, bright blue music, green, purple, orange, and other colors. And this is a new one from Michael Torkey, and I think maybe he can translate heat and humidity into music. This is from his new CD called Tahiti, and it's the first movement of a work called Tahiti.
Wonderful, charming music called Tahiti. And we're going to wrap up this part of Sound Advice with music that will be familiar to filmgoers.
Yes, it's hard to believe that 10 years ago, the first Lord of the Rings movie came out. Howard Shore composed the music for all of the trilogy of movies, The Lord of the Rings, and took about 12 hours of music and condensed it down to a symphony, a choral symphony, and he calls it The Lord of the Rings Symphony.
Well, that is outstandingly stirring music.
You know, it reminds me a bit of Carmina Burana by Carl Orff.
I wanted to say that too. I'm glad you did. Thank you.
His music is not derivative at all, though, but it's wonderful. And actually, there will be a performance of the Lord of the Rings Symphony in Sacramento on October 23rd at Power Balance Pavilion. So we can hear it and see it. They project images, still images, up on the screen as they play the symphony. It's wonderful.
Sounds beautiful. Kent Teeter is the morning host in Capital Public Radio's classical station, joining us with classical sound advice today. We'll go out with more music from the Lord of the Rings Symphony. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's Insight for today. We'll be back on Tuesday.